Session number 11214, row 12.
Colonel Jourdain, Reel 12. Where did you live while you were in Riga?
Yes, first of all, I lived in a Russian family. You know, fairly aristocratic Russian family. There were quite a lot of them in Latvia at the time. But it wasn't very satisfactory. And later I moved into a house run by two old German women. There are a lot of sort of old German women in Riga. I mean, they merely had a flat. And the actual instruction came from this Countess Klein Michel.
Were there any other British officers with you?
One. There was one other chap, and he lived somewhere else.
Were you aware of the political situation in Latvia at the time, and sort of generally in that area of Europe?
It was all very quiet and normal. And it was treated as somebody there. I was asked to lunch by the Latvian Minister of War, that kind of thing, and the British ambassador asked one of the dues there. We were treated quite amiably, shall I say, because we were British officers. I mean, that was the idea. But one didn't really know much about the country because, A, it was difficult to move about, and, B, there was this language thing. Of course, one could speak German to a certain number of people. And one was working reasonably hard.
You said you passed the exam. Did you find the construction of the Russian language difficult to grasp? Or?
Do you mean at the outset?
Yes, really, yeah.
Well, I'd had this preliminary thing at London University, you see, some years and years before, so I knew what I was up against. And, I was trying to find, there are a lot of exercise books there full of exercises I did for this good lady, who would she correct? And I obviously did know the language quite well. And in that thing there's a little label of an address label from Pravda in Moscow, sending me Pravda from Moscow when I went to India afterwards. The Indian government got hold of that. I mean, the British part of the Indian government got hold of this. Here's a British officer having papers sent from Moscow to Rawalpindi. And why was I doing that? I said, I'm doing that because I want to read the Russian papers. They were quite sensible about it. They said, oh, we'll send you the papers now. And then this idiotic thing, which I mentioned before, look at the thing, mark anything that's interesting, don't translate it, mark it, and we'll get it translated. I was perfectly capable of translating it at the time, but I think that was something to do with the Union of Translators. However, that's, by the way, that's a trivial thing. But it's great pity because I wish to God I'd been able to keep up my Russian. But it was swamped. I had to learn Hindustani.
So, were you frustrated when you were posted to India? I mean,
no, I liked India. India, I found, was a better place to be a soldier in that particular period of history than certainly than Aldershot. But then I'm not a cricketer or something of that sort. If I'd have been, well, even so, cricket was a lot of cricket in India. But the athletes would much rather be in England than in India.
But you found, although you found India fairly boring, it was less so than Aldershot.
It was better than Aldershot.
So what were you posted to in India this time out? Rawalpindi, you said?
Yes, 1st Indian Divisional Signals, commanded by the man who I mentioned before, when I'd been out there before, who left me carrying the can.
Didn't that cause a little friction? I mean, did you ever mention it to him?
No, I never mentioned it. Yes, he was commanding it, and then he got promoted then to be full colonel and still there. Oh, no, everything was quite nice and gentlemanly. The other chap was there, too. The two of them were there, but the other one very soon went sick and went home. The first thing the other chap said to me was, because I was commanding for a bit while the first one was on leave, Jourdain, of course, I shan't be able to go to this frontier war because I'm not at all well. End of story.
You felt he was backsliding there, then?
But never mind, he'd played cricket for Somerset once. Now you understand. No, but I enjoyed that trip in India, that last one.
What was your job within the signal, the first division?
Well, I was second in command. They didn't have a second in command as such. In other words, in England there were more officers in the divisional signals than there were in India, quite partly because, of course, India had a number of Indian officers as well in the unit. They were a slightly different category. They held no command over British troops, as you probably know, and they dressed with stars and crowns and things. They commanded Indian troops, or the Indian part of it, but they always seemed to get on quite well with the British troops. The British troops always behaved very well towards them. And it's a weird situation, that. I mean, having chaps dressed as captains who couldn't officially command any of the British soldiers. And the British soldiers always seemed to behave very well towards them.
Would you rather they'd been integrated? I mean, if they had been proper officers... I mean, how did you feel about it?
I didn't feel about it, because one must remember that one's talking about certain periods in history. It was the status quo, if you like, of that period, and it seemed all right. It wouldn't be all right now.
So it seems strange to you in retrospect?
Yes, in retrospect, I think. At the time, it seemed perfectly normal. They were a great help to the people like myself. But not a great number of them could speak English.
Now, was wireless coming in more now?
Just. I'm trying to think of one wasn't very conscious of it. This second trip in India, I was in, first of all, in a divisional signals with these people I've just mentioned. That had its wireless bit. But for all that, things like horse-drawn cable wagons were still very much in evidence. And then I got moved to DIK, Dera Ismail Khan.
DIK, sorry?
Dera Ismail Khan is a station on the frontier. And there were one or two smaller units commanded by majors, not lieutenant colonels. And I was given one of them.
And what was this unit called? I mean, what...
Certain sort of district signals. This was Waziristan district signals.
And that was just its name?
That was its name.
And what was life like on the frontier?
Well, I'm no frontier expert. I know very little about it. But DIK and Rusmuk and one or two places around there, I did know. The only startling thing I did was to take my wife up to Rusmuk, which is rarely on the frontier, where no women have ever gone before, I don't think, in the car with a moustache painted on like that, nominally smoking a pipe, right up to this place at the top and right down the other side, with my little Indian orderly, a boy really, in the back having a fit when he suddenly realised who was the passenger was. And we went up there and we came down, and it took about, say, 2 to 3 hours. I'd sent a telegram. This is like going around a triangle, the apex being much higher than the base. And, of course, I'd said I'm going from A to B across the base, which we'll say would take an hour. But in point of fact, I went from A to C to B, which took 2 hours. All the people at B were having kittens because they wondered what on earth had happened to him, because he disappeared into the blue. They didn't know I'd gone up to Rusmuk with my wife, you see. Anyhow, that blew over all right. Nobody got hurt.
Why did you want to go to... I mean, what...
Well, it's just the daring. And no women, as far as I know, no women had ever been there before. And she was game. And she painted this moustache on, smoked a pipe, and nobody thought there was anything unusual about it. In point of fact, it was a lady. And
was there much trouble on the frontier at that
time? No, not really, no. There was always a little kind of frisson, whatever you like to wear. You never knew what was going to happen. I never ran into anything much. I'd gone before the last frontier war broke out. My brother-in-law was there when it did break out. But there were none of them particularly serious. But they were things that required a great deal of stamina for the people taking part in them.
Why was that?
Marching about long distances, climbing up and down mountains, having what are called pickets on, to protect the body of troops moving along. It was a very active life. I didn't see much of it because I was oscillating between this place on the, actually on the frontier, and one just below it. I'd like to have been there longer, but...
What was the social life like on the frontier? I mean, was it still based around the club? I mean...
Well, if there were a club, yes, there was a club at Rosmark, I think. I can't remember it now. There was one at DIK, but it wasn't half so marked as it was further down into the country.
You mentioned your servant. How did you get on with the Indian servant?
Oddly enough, when I first went out to India, I had a Madrasi. It's a very unusual thing to have a Madrasi as a servant, but he was a very good chap.
Why was it unusual? I mean,
well, they were... People rather liked to have people from further north in India, more manly races, if you like. But I took him over from somebody else. Now, believe it or not, that same chap turned up again when I came out to India the second time. I might never have been coming out. But I did come out, and they find out things like that. Anyway, he was my servant for the second trip out again. And this one I was talking about, but they very often had a equivalent of a pantry boy or something like that. This boy, Motilal, who would... I think he'd been with me before, too. They're both... They're quite capable of turning up at Bombay when you come out. You may... The way the Bush Telegraph gets round is nobody's business. And my brother-in-law will tell you that bachelors would hand over their pay to their servants. Their complete trust. The curious relationship and there were duds, I suppose, but not many.
Did you pay them much?
I don't know what much means, you see. I can't remember what it was, but it wouldn't mean anything very much. It depends on what you buy with it. They were always treated well, I think, never extravagantly. And I suppose the only word is they were usually very faithful to their master, not necessarily somebody else, I suppose. And I think he'll tell you that as a bachelor, he would hand over his pay to the bearer. The man's called a bearer. He would hand over his pay to the bearer every month.
Now, how long were you up at the frontier? You weren't there long,
No. Maybe in 2 years or something. That's what I'm trying to think.
So this moving into towards the mid-30s, 34, 35, perhaps.
Then we come to the crash. I was scheduled, or the word you like to use, to go to the senior officer school in southern India somewhere, which all majors had to go to then, or did go to then, before they were made lieutenant colonels. And you didn't go to the senior officer school unless you were going to be a lieutenant colonel. It was, I suppose there was one in England. Everything was going quite all right when the War Office, who did not own me at that time, remember I was paid for by the government of India and so on, said, we're not going to promote this chap. Now that, of course, was a pretty shattering blow.
Why was that?
The reason eventually came out was I had been involved in a divorce case in... I forget, yeah, but say 5 or 6 years before, I mean quite a long time before, which had been reported and dealt with at the time. But there was an almost evil man who was the adjutant general in 19, whatever it was now, I mean in that period we're talking about, who would go to most wicked lengths to do in professionally anybody who'd been through the divorce court. I mean, you can find, I'm not going to dig it all up now, but there are things, articles in Truth about it, there were members of Parliament onto it, about me. And the whole of India, so to speak, I mean, I'm not exaggerating, were on my side. I mean, Milosin and I was their employee, they wanted to employ me again. But the Adjutant General overruled the Military Secretary, and I can prove it now, there's no need to bother about it now, but I couldn't at the time, except for the fact that I knew Sir Stafford Cripps quite well. I, when I was in MI6, a most extraordinary thing happened. A clerk in the War Office sent my personal files, you better not record, you can record this as you like, sent my personal files, which you are never meant to see in the army, the one thing you're never meant to see is your personal file, sent it to MI6. And the bit of MI6 that sent it to was me. And it had the whole works in it, which proved quite satisfactory to me. It was this man who was the Adjutant General, was behind this all. He was a bigot of the First Order. And everybody else got overruled. And that can be proved. I mean, I naturally took some copies of this, as you can imagine. But that's a most extraordinary thing. And the military secretary, I don't know if you know all these things, is the man who rarely adjudicates on officers' matters, was overruled by the Adjutant General. But we needn't go into all that now. But there was an amazing case of bigotry, if ever there was one.
I wonder if you don't mind, if you could just...
No, I'm just wondering how I can compress it sensibly. I think the basic thing was I had an affair with a woman who said she was not married and she was. That's the basis of the whole thing. You see. And that led to a great deal of trouble, as you can imagine, because I didn't just throw everything over. And it was dealt with locally, so to speak, perfectly satisfactorily. It was only when this particular Adjutant General came along and dug up things which by then were, shall we say, 6 or 7 years old, to stymie my promotion to Lieutenant Colonel. That's the essence of the thing, that what had been accepted, reported on, and dealt with, it's certainly not less than 5 years ago, maybe, say 5 or 6 years ago, is resurrected to blackmail me for promotion to Lieutenant Colonel. But in England, when in point of fact I was employed and being recommended, where I'd been in India some time and employed by them, but still, of course, belonging to the British establishment. Now, I don't really think one need go into further details to any extent, but that was the gist of the thing. And the interesting thing is, the bit I was coming on to, that while I was in MI6 in 1940 or 41, somewhere like that, a clerk in the War Office sent the whole of my file over to MI6. This is really the interesting part, because you're never supposed to see your own file.
You said that, yes.
But, yes?
You said that just before, yes. What I wondered was, how did people come to take up your case? You said MPs and Truth and... How did they come to get involved? Or you said it was partially anonymously as well. What exactly happened? Why did your case attract some attention?
Well, I think because it was grossly unfair.
And that was picked up on?
And that was picked up on various people. I mean, I appealed to the proper drill is to appeal to the military secretary, and I did do that. And Sir Stafford Cripps came into this, who I knew at the time. It all sounds rather disjointed, this, but I mean, it was going on over a period. I'd really like you to see the letters I've gotten somewhere. But anyhow, the thing ended in a sort of stymied. I was stopped from promotion to Lieutenant Colonel. That meant that you were out of the army, and which is a fairly dastardly thing for him to do, this in particular.
Could you just explain why you were out of the army? Was that because you were over the age limit?
No, because if you're not promoted, or at that particular time, and for a long time before it, if you were not promoted to Lieutenant Colonel, you were put on the retired list, when you would have been promoted to Lieutenant Colonel. And that's what happened to me. I then got various kinds of employment, including, as it happens, MI6.
And when did you leave the army? Was that 36 you left the army?
I suppose so, yes.
And you came back to England, of course.
I came straight back to England and was on the dole, in fact, for about a week.
Were you embittered by what?
Oh, yes, of course I was. I mean, it didn't as if the thing had not been reported and not been dealt with, but to dig it up and like that, because you can always dig it up when somebody's going for a Lieutenant Colonel, because you've only got to blackball them and they're finished. Now they would go on being Lieutenant Colonels and not being promoted further or something of that sort. But anyhow, that I was bitter. I came back here, I got, after a time, I got quite a nice job in the Air Ministry.
Is that before or after the MI6 connection?
This is before MI6.
What job did you get at the Air Ministry?
I was, I appeared in the Air Force list as a major, which is a bit of an achievement. I was in the signal branch of the Air Ministry, that's the point. They had a signal branch. And I may say that the boss of the signal branch, who was an Air Marshal, wanted to get me into the Air Force. But the Army, with their characteristic generosity, wouldn't let me go because they had my reserve liability in their pocket. In other words, if a war broke out, they could claim my body. It was very thoughtful of them. And they wouldn't let me take a regular commission in the Air Force. I wasn't sorry because I did not want to be an airman without wings. Snobbish, if you like. But, I mean, I wouldn't have been an infantry soldier and so on. I didn't like the idea of being a wingless airman. Anyhow, I was not able to take up this offer. But at about the same time, and for no particular reason, MI6...
Hang on just a moment. Hmm? Now, while you were at the MS, you say you were listed as a major. Were you actually in the RAF?
Or no, but I was in the... it's in the outside.
It's an honorary rank, then? Or?
No, they simply, you'll find in a particular Air Force list, in the staff of the Air Ministry, X, Y, and Z, and Major FWSJ.
And what job were you doing there, then?
I was doing something to do with landlines for the Air Force in England. I invented a form for it. It's the only achievement I got in the Air Force. I got... in the playroom there, the special form for recording landlines used by the Air Force in England. But it was very interesting because the way the Air Force conduct their business is very different from the Army. You go to meetings and warrant officers would speak up with their vice marshals there and all that. Quite different.
So you found it a much more open...
Oh, yes. And even in my capacity, whatever it was, I could go into any Air Force mess in England and say, I've come for lunch and pay for it and go away again.
Do you think the greater openness and the fact that junior ranks were able to actually converse seriously with higher ranks, do you think that made for more efficiency?
I should think so, you know. Provided they, at the same time, they know their place, you know what I mean, but then they don't get conceited about it.
And do you know the actual department this landlines was in of the Air Ministry?
Telegraph lines and that sort of thing. Oh, it was the signal department. They had a signals directorate with an Air Vice Marshal as the boss. And I had quite a happy time there, I forget, possibly 2 years, when suddenly out of the blue, MI6 wanted to pick me up and did.
Now, what year would that be? Would that be around 38 or...?
Very close to the war. When did the war begin? End of 39, was it?
September 39.
Well, it must have been early in 39, I think.
And how did they actually make contact with you?
No, I've forgotten. It's always very sub rosa, anything of that sort. I was... First thing I remember being interviewed by the boss's show, the Admiral.
Do you remember his name?
No, but I will, before you go.
What type of an interview was it? What were they looking for, do you think?
They knew all your records and that kind of thing. It was all rather melodramatic. I mean, you went upstairs and there was a room with a little red light outside the door, and when that changed to green, you were pushed inside. And very much to my surprise, the Admiral was dressed in uniform. And he asked me two or three questions. I can't remember what they were. I think he said he liked the cut of my jib or words to that effect. No, that was another Admiral.
Were your languages or your signals?
Theoretically, a bit of both, all that. Because I went in the signal bit of the MI6. And anyhow, I got taken on there for a time.
What building were you working from?
Well, at first it was this well-known spot, 54 Broadway, opposite the tube station. And then, fairly soon after that, we moved out of the country and we went to Warren Hall, near Bletchley. Not Bletchley itself, but near Bletchley.
Now, when you were on the Broadway, was this meant to be a... you said it was well-known. Was it meant to be a secret establishment, or was it...
Oh, yes, very much so. I think It had a front door facing the tube station and another door out on, is it Queen Anne Street on the other side of the park? But I wasn't there very long.
What was its cover? I mean, what was it meant to be, this building, if you see what I mean?
Well, there were a lot of other things in the same building. I mean, presumably it was an office block.
And they had a floor in it?
Hmm.
And what kind of work were they doing in there? I mean, what was the setup?
How should I know? No, but I mean, I don't know. I mean, I met various people. I mean, for instance, I met those two chaps who were nabbed on the frontier between Brussels and Belgium and Holland, wasn't it? At the beginning of the war, you may have not heard of it. At any rate, there were two of the chaps, I did know them. They put their foot in it pretty literally on the Dutch-Belgian border, I think, and got locked up for the rest of the war in Germany. Things like that.
You weren't very aware of what was going on.
No, because remember, we were the signal bit of the show. We knew a certain amount of what was going on, but we were not concerned with spying, to put it vulgarly. I went out to Brussels after the beginning of the war.
Hang on there. While you were... So, you started off... did you move up to near Bletchley before the start of the war? Or were you still at the Broadway when the war started?
I can't honestly remember, but it makes no difference. It's only a matter of days or something, or weeks, something like that. You see, the body of the Secret Service were at Bletchley, weren't they? Most of them. I mean, that's sort of well-known now, all the cipher-breaking and so on was done there, and we were the signal bit. I mean, for instance,
What was the composition of the signal bit? How many of them?
About half a dozen, what you might call officers. We did not only might call officers; we called ourselves officers and made ourselves lieutenant colonels and things like that. That's the first time I became a lieutenant colonel, in spite of the machinations of the War Office. And
you were all much of a rank. I mean, you were all...
No, the boss was a chap called Gambier Perry. He made himself a brigadier eventually. People like me were satisfied with being lieutenant colonels.
And how did the department, the signals unit, work within MI6?
Oh, it had some pretty able systems. We ran a sort of duplication of whatever the telegraph system is to all the embassies in Europe. That was the sort of idea. And for instance...
how did that work? I'm not quite clear.
Simply by having very good wireless sets manned by our own people. I remember, I think, after the war had begun, I went out to Budapest, Bucharest, and what's the other one? Belgrade, attending to those matters.
What did that involve?
Well, I took a new operator out, we took new sets out. I knew, one dealt with the ambassadors in person quite a lot. I mean, it was quite good stuff. Next time you come, I'll dig out one or two pieces of paper about that, which you might like to see.
And what would you do when you got to an embassy, say, in Bucharest or somewhere? I mean, how would you go about?
I don't know. You were more or less received at the top table. Except, where was it? Bucharest, I think they were living in the Victorian age. They were all elderly gents smoking large cigars and so on. And I say, old chap, would you mind posting this on your way back home? That kind of thing.
And you'd be taking, say, a new operator or a...
Yes, yes. I mean, there was a complicated system of communications from, say, Belgrade to Bratislava to Alexandria to London. There's a kind of complete network superimposed on everything else.
And these would be sending messages in code, would they?
Yes, mostly. They had these, it's a fairly commonplace expression, I've forgotten one, the once-only codes. The simplest thing of codes was, is there a La Russe, little red Russian, French dictionary there?
That's the La Russe French dictionary.
Yes. This particular one was probably used for you might not put all this down, I think, operators in Belgium sending messages to England, very slow cipher. The, you get the word is page 364, and I forget what it differentiates between this column and that, 5, and probably 0.